Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. Today, the Southern Fork is supported by you. Really, a few weeks ago, I requested nominations for Outstanding Food Podcasts for the Savoir Magazine Blog Awards, and the Southern Fork is now officially a finalist. Wow! Thank you so much to all of you who voted, and since there's another round, I'm asking if you'll vote again, if you feel so inclined. Go to savour.com/blogawards to vote. Remember, Savour is spelled S-A-V-E-U-R. And check out the other finalists in a bunch of categories there, too. I'm thrilled to have the chance to bring these culinary conversations to you, and it means a lot that you're listening and you want to join in on the fun. Thanks for helping me get the stories of the Southern Fork out there. I have one final interview from my recent attendance at the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival, and I've been saving it until now. While visiting the ATL, I was thrilled to have the chance to sit down with author David Wondrich, and since he's about to visit Charleston as part of BevCon in a little over a week, it seemed perfect timing to talk about tipples. David Wondrich is the Daily Beast Senior Drinks columnist and the James Beard Award-winning author of Imbibe and Punch, and is one of those people that, frankly, I professionally stand on the shoulders of, although sometimes shakily, as you'll notice in my George Washington comment. He is a master researcher and can take that dusty research and weave it into a hell of a story, all the while sliding a cocktail to you across the bar, in real life or virtually in recipe form. He has a twinkle in his eye most of the time, maybe because he left a job he hated so much and found one that fascinates him. But through his fascination, we have gained volumes of knowledge about the often hazy history of cocktails. And he's a New Yorker. But without him, I wouldn't know the background of the mint julep, or the punches of the port cities, or so many other iconic beverages of the South, stories I find intriguing and delicious. If you might find those interesting too, then settle in for a bit of a seance with a cocktail shaker, as David so deftly explains. Welcome to the Southern Fork, David Wondrich.
I'm very happy to be here.
Well, here is inside yet another hotel room in the Lowe's during the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival.
I look at it as being my Atlanta home away from home.
Yes.
My southern headquarters.
This is great. Well, when you're not in Charleston.
When I'm not in Charleston, that's right. Or New Orleans, that's, or, you know, any one of a number of other cities.
Exactly.
But yeah.
This is a great festival. You've participated for years in this festival.
This is maybe my sixth year, something like that. I've been coming here for quite a while
and
now.
Yesterday we learned about peach brandy.
That was fun to talk about.
Yeah, that was just a really obscure thing. How did you first come across that?
Well, I'd been reading, old cocktail books would talk about peach brandy and old distiller's manuals. You know, I like anything like that. I'm always curious, like, how did they make it? What did it taste like?
Mm-hmm.
Just the basic questions, because often we don't even ask those questions.
Right. We'll move on.
We'll just say, oh, peach brandy. Okay, I can get peach brandy at the store, and we don't realize it's completely different.
Right.
You know, and so, but I always like to look into the origins of things. And, you know, when I was a kid, I would take things apart and I'd sometimes be able to put them back together again.
So do you spend a lot of time actually in libraries?
Not so much these days, because most of the research I do is in like newspaper databases and things like that.
Like microfiche? Remember how the old microfiche?
God, yes. But,
and you would get so nauseated from like scrolling, scrolling.
Yeah.
I remember getting that nauseated.
Well, a lot of that stuff is available online now. So, you know, I use that because the kind of research I do, if you're searching for a mention of a cocktail in 1884 and you have to look at it in microfilm, you're reading those papers almost in real time. You know?
Yes.
You can get through 4 days.
I know.
So
yeah.
You
and
can't
then,
really do anything.
And if you're like me, you're like, oh, look at that advertisement for stockings for 15 cents. And then
you're
like, wait, focus.
Oh, yeah. You're always chasing rabbits.
Totally.
But with this, I still chase rabbits, but now I catch them and file them away for future
use.
You're
like, good.
So, you know, that goes into the archive, that stockings thing.
But like distilling manuals,
those you get them in libraries. Some you can get online. They put a lot of college library books online right now through this thing, the Hathi Trust, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you have to have like some kind of college login, but I have it from being an alumnus, and it's really useful. And there's and other times you just like you know break down, go to the library, and get interlibrary loan and stuff like that. But
so in a way, you're doing what you did before,
you're
researching not a dead author.
Well,
but you're researching cocktails that you're reviving.
Well, what's funny is when I was in grad school, and I have a PhD in comp lit in comparative literature, which took a long time and was really interesting. But the whole time I was studying, they kept telling me, everybody would say, you know, what are you going to do with that? So, you know, if you don't get a good academic job, you're going to be driving a cab, which is funny because I don't have a driver's license. So that would be a big trick. I'm a New Yorker. But
that's true. Like, don't get in David's cab.
Yeah, no.
David's like, you ready to go? This is my first time.
You know, I wouldn't be the only New York cab driver without a license.
This is true.
I will say that. But anyway, so they kept telling me that. And the funny thing is, you know, I went and I dutifully applied for a professor job and got one in New York. And I was pretty miserable. It was the worst job I ever had. And it was a tenure track job.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just really not cut out for that work. I liked the research. I just didn't. And I liked the teaching. I didn't like the bureaucracy and all that stuff. And
the ivory tower bureaucracy is a very particular animal.
Yeah, those people are mean. Mm-hmm. And I just hate people telling me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I always have. And these were people telling me what to do. And it was just made me miserable. And I found out that, you know, those skills are actually extremely useful anywhere else in the world if you have just a little bit of imagination, which some academics don't, but many do. And you can use that stuff, you know, research skills.
I research.
Skills.
I mean, this is what I do. I have an MFA. MFA people. I have an MA in American Lit 20th Century, and I studied the Lost Generation writers.
Right. Yeah.
And I did my thesis on Dorothy Parker. And
so, yeah, you know how to research this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you break down and you do the research.
Yeah.
And this is what it is.
And there's something to that. There's something really fun. Like, I wrote about, I chased a rabbit last year. A cocktail rabbit, writing about variation on the Cuba Libre that was a Venezuelan.
Oh yeah, I found
variation. Did you ever see that?
Somebody, I read this amazing book. God, I can't remember the title of it. Last year, it was this guy's memoirs, and he was a soldier of fortune in South America in the early part of the 20th century. And in like 1909, he's drinking rum and Coca-Cola in Venezuela, you know, with the revolutionaries there. Well, they made him the charge of the machine gun battalion, which was one machine gun and no ammunition. So, you know, and this guy was like a 21-year-old American.
Wow.
It was a pretty crazy book.
But the Venezuelan one had a gin floater.
Oh,
London Dry Gin Floater, or at least the Venezuelan version that I heard of and chased
good.
Back.
That sounds better.
It was delicious with fresh lime zest.
Yeah, that sounds good.
It was really, really good. And so now I try to get bartenders to make that. But
well, you know, South America has a long history of those drinks with sweet soda. And it's like the national drinks of half of South America are those.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like it's not weird down there.
So you're having to research bunch right now because you're working on your next book.
Yeah, I've been.
I mean, you're researching all the time because you're writing all the time. Yeah. But what is the next thing that you're doing? It's a beast.
I'm the editor in chief of the Oxford Companion to Spirits and Cocktails, which I got talked into.
And, so you finally got to write an Oxford Companion,
David. Oh Lordy, it's a lot of work. It's just a lot of work, and I'm the slowest writer on earth because I have to research everything like 88 different ways before I'm going to write it down. You know, I don't like approach that stuff
casually.
But that's
why we like you, because then we can just quote you.
Well,
we know you do that.
Because hopefully I've done all the research, but you know, you've never done all the research is the problem. And so this is, I run into my problems like, I don't really know the story, but I really got to write this.
Yeah.
You know, that always drives me nuts, but it's getting there. We're beginning to, we're not sliding into the home stretch, but we've rounded third and we're chugging away.
Is it two volumes or is
One volume. It'll be one
huge,
fat volume.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, you basically created a job, which is a cocktail historian. I mean, there really wasn't that level of,
there were a couple people who are really good at it.
Right.
When I started, William Grimes was really good at it. The guy from Wired, I'm having a mental block, who wrote the Wired book in 1999, and his writing partner, they did a great job. But there really wasn't a lot. Ted Hay, Dr. Cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few people who, you know, paid attention.
I'm glad you didn't call yourself Dr. Cocktail.
Well, it was taken.
Yeah.
I don't do that anyway.
I
try not to make a big deal out of all that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's only worth something. It's only worth what your work is worth. You know,
right.
It's not worth anything beyond that.
Right. By the way, David is not really into the idea of branding, are you, David? You're
not
in the
so
idea
much.
Of working.
Yeah, I like to get out and talk to people, and I like to write I like to research my stuff. I hate writing. I really am a very reluctant writer because it's hard work, and I don't like hard
it
work.
It is hard work. It is. It's hard.
Yeah, but you know, it's what I can do. So
right,
it's
right.
What people will pay me to do.
Exactly. And I think at one point I've tried to quit. You know, it's like an addiction and you try to quit for years. And I kept saying, no one will hire me as like a dental front of like, I want to be in a dental office,
running
the office.
And like, doing word search puzzles.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah, that would be nice.
And I was like, how am I getting that? And they would look at me. I was like, I have an MA and I can run a computer. And they're like, if you get a writing job or you're out. I'm like, yes, I'm out.
Sorry.
Yeah. So they're like, you're going to leave as soon as you get writing gigs. Well, all of the writing, I learned about you through reading you in Esquire, which you had a long tenure there as a contributing editor. And you were there during the cusp of when they were taking and putting a lot of these cocktails online, and there was this major cocktail database.
Well, yeah, I got hired at the... In December 1999, I was a junior professor, and I was writing about music on the side for the Village Voice and occasionally for the Sunday New York Times.
Not bad gigs. That's a pretty good gig.
That's pretty
too.
Good. Yeah. Neither one of those paid anything though, right. You know, because it's writing about music.
Right.
But I got to write about like. I was into like hillbilly music and ragtime and stuff like that. And I got to write about that. And one day in December, my friend calls me up. He was the web director for Hearst Magazines, which was a small job at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my friend Josh Mack. And he says, I've got this project for the Esquire website, and I thought maybe you could do it. And I was like, well, I'm really busy, you know, it's finals. He said, well, it pays $3,000. And for a junior professor, that was like all the money in the world.
And you were like, yes, I'll do
yes,
it.
Yes, I'll do it.
What is it?
Yeah, exactly. So, and it turned out to be taking the cocktails part of their 1949 handbook for hosts and arranging it and editing it so it could go online because they wanted a bigger web presence and they wanted to get that all. So I kind of sorted the drinks out and I threw out a whole lot of them, many of which I later threw back in because it turned out I threw out a lot of good ones too.
Oh, yeah.
But I threw out a lot of pretty, pretty no account ones too. But, and then some of them had these little essays on these little like paragraphs of prose about the drink. And I liked those. So I wrote a couple more in the same style and attached them there. And David Granger, the editor in chief at Esquire, he'd been there for a couple of years, says, "Hey, I like those. Can you do one of those a week?" And so I did a drink of the week column for Esquire.com for about 3 years. And that's where the drinks database came from. Mm-hmm. Was, you know, every week.
I still send people to those, like, because I get that question. And they and I send people there and say, just type in what you have in your fridge and what liquor you have.
It was a fun project. I mean, it's everything on there is woefully out of date because I wrote it, you know, I stopped updating it in 2003. So it's really old. But on the other hand, it's the writing is pretty fresh because I was really enjoying it and I was doing it on the side. But eventually I just hated my academic job so much and I had contracts for a couple books that I thought I was going to get rich on and didn't. But I wrote those and quit my job, and then I've been doing this ever since. So
that's great. Well, the books maybe didn't get rich, but they're really good.
Well, the ones, these were even earlier.
The earlier ones, yeah.
Then I wrote Imbibe about Jerry Thomas, which I spent some actual time on, and that one that one did okay and is you know, helped me out all over the world. So that's good.
Well, before we go on, because I'd like to talk about punch, because punch in the South and punches in general are awesome. What makes a no-account drink? You said that you threw out some no-account drinks.
There were some, like, Prohibition-era ones that were all booze. You know, it's like mix gin, brandy, and whiskey, you know, stuff like that. Those nobody needs to drink. I mean, I tried some of them, and then I'm like, okay, I don't need those. And there were others that were just minor variations on the martini or something like that. And eventually I realized that you really don't need to put those in there because unless they have a really good story.
Right.
If there's a good story, anything with a good story goes in.
Right.
That's rule number one.
You got to tell stories while you're sitting there drinking.
Yeah,
so
it's fun.
That's
part
of the thing.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's
like the
I
Venezuelan machine gun battalion of one.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So punch. I have made punches at home for years and years and years before because I simply don't like standing behind making the drinks.
Yeah.
I wanted to be one and done so I can enjoy my guests. And also, I didn't want to have a cocktail bar. Like, I didn't want all those liquors. I didn't have the money. I had enough to make a Purple Jesus variation when I was a kid. And then I started experimenting and doing things. My most popular one was a French 75 punch.
Oh, that's
Hi,
that's
Kat.
Dangerous.
How are you? Yeah, and all my girlfriends, because I like gin, so I drink a lot of gin. And girlfriends, no. So I did it for a girl's craft party.
Oh, there you go.
So then it went to a new level. Like, crafts were a completely...
Crafts get redefined when you're drinking from 75.
Punches. And then all the girls were like, this is really good. What is this? And
that's
I was
great.
Like, it's just like a version of lemonade, basically, with champagne and gin.
Cunningly flavored lemonade, as the Prince of Wales once said about American drinks.
That's great. So punches are such a big... That's a great book, and we go through it, and I loved reading it. And I'm not using a good vocab word before coffee. Great. That's a great book. But you have a lot in there that are Southern punches. I mean, Southern punches were the thing. One of your favorite punches.
Oh, maybe my favorite of all time is Chatham Artillery Punch.
I love your quote. I like seeing people get a little more drunk than they realize they're going to get.
I used to play in punk bands. So there's a little evil side there that it just amuses me. You know, it's like, all right. Let's see what you're gonna do. Let's see what happens.
Like,
here.
Good luck. Oh, I know it's limited.
You get some really, really fun times. You got to make sure that there's not an unlimited supply.
Right. And then we're gonna go to something lighter for sure, some beer.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Chatham Artillery. Why is it so iconic for you?
Well, it's delicious. It's strong. It's got a really long tradition back to the 1850s. And, you know, this cool story, it was the pride of Savannah forever. It was the thing they trotted out whenever anybody came to town to test them against. So they were being a little dickish about it. Mm-hmm. But you know, there was also that kind of amuses me too.
Yeah,
it's like, all right, you know, welcome to town.
I think I had that at Empire State South. Remember when you did the whole Brooks Reeds and Greg Best, and you did that big thing, and you're over here with the punch, and you're like, hey. You just slide it there, and everyone's like, what is this? You're like, it's punch.
It's punch. It's just delicious.
Just have a sip.
Yeah, we bottled it one year here, and we called it Chap, and we put labels on it. And
I was here that year.
With the same logo as Coke, because it's the two iconic Georgia drinks, Chatham Artillery Punch and Coke.
If I saw a chef that had a little bottle of Chap, I was like, Wadberth.
Yeah. Well, because the problem was our bottles were too big.
Yeah.
And the stuff was really strong.
Yeah. So what's in a Chatham Artillery?
Okay. Well, it's one part each of rum, gin, and brandy.
Mm-hmm.
One part of mixed lemon juice and sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And then three parts of champagne. Yeah.
It's a lot. It's fizzy, though, in a bottle. It's wonderful.
It's wonderful. Oh, it's wonderful however you get it.
Yes, yes.
It's just like this, you taste the lemon. You taste the kind of boozy.
A little sweet.
The champagne stretches it out. And I've made it on many, many memorable or not so memorable occasions.
I've made it twice. There's a Charleston one. There's a Charleston punch, too, mm-hmm. that has tea.
Yeah,
I usually do a variation of a tea punch.
Yeah, there's the St. Cecilia punch from
Charleston.
That's
the one that I usually do, because I'm like, I need something in here that is not booze.
I didn't put it in my book because I couldn't find a really good old recipe, and then I found a pretty old one after the book came out. So if I ever get to do a second edition, that'll be in there.
That'll be in there for sure. A lot of these old recipes use brandy, and mm-hmm. you spoke about brandy yesterday, and I was at Copper and King's just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Brandon. Love your absinthe. Think it's awesome. But
a huge amount of American domestic brandy is made, some of which is pretty dull, some mm-hmm. of which is actually pretty good if you give it a chance,
mm-hmm.
and it's starting to get better. And
how do we pick a good brandy? Because you need a decent one.
You need a decent one, and I'm very finicky about it because mm-hmm. I can be. For me, the French brandies, I want it to be a VSOP grade because the cheaper VS grade just isn't concentrated enough tasting for me. Mm-hmm. And I just can't taste it right in the drinks. So I need an older one for that, which drives up the cost considerably. So mm-hmm. I don't make brandy drinks every day, put it that mm-hmm. way. But boy, when I do, they're among my very favorites.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yesterday I made a punch with peach brandy and Armagnac. And rum that came out very well.
That was good.
That was good, right?
That was really good.
That was really good.
Why do you think we need to know the history of these cocktails?
I don't think we need to know it. I think it's fun to know it. That's my thing. It's just fun. It gives you things to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It, for me, when I know the history of a drink, all those people who were drinking it before are kind of looking over my shoulder, and I'm kind of clinking glasses with them a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I almost feel like I'm getting away with something, you know,
right.
if I'm drinking like something historic, especially if it's something that hasn't been drunk in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was making the Fish House Punch with peach brandy yesterday with real peach brandy. That feels just like, you know, reaching across the generations to clink glasses with, mm-hmm. with those people back then. That just amuses me, you know.
And we get these stories that we don't get, like we get the not so for publication kind of stories,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the machine gun guy is some that we would learn in eighth grade history.
Yeah, no,
you know?
That guy, Dean Ivan Lamb is his name, and if you ever see his book. Dean Ivan Lamb was a sick pup.
Man, soldier of fortune.
It opens with him in New Orleans in a poker game, he wins the pot and collects the money, and they're waiting for him to ante up, and he says, okay, I'm out. And they chase him, and he runs all the way to the levee and jumps on a steamboat and goes to Venezuela.
Oh, my God.
That's how it starts. It's like, it's total Indiana Jones.
You should totally write a screenplay for that. Yeah. It would be a great movie.
He was quite the character, and he ends up founding the Peruvian Air Force and all mm-hmm. this stuff like that. It's just nuts.
A Peruvian Air Force? That's so random.
Yeah, he was a pilot.
So when you're researching these cocktails and mm-hmm. you see something and it excites you, and then you're in your house going, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to write about this. I'm mm-hmm. going to write about this cocktail. And I don't know what this tastes like, or I want to taste it before I write about it. That's the first time you have that experience, really, alone, shaking hands, or with one or two people, shaking hands with those people mm-hmm. across mm-hmm. the way. So that's a very intimate.
It's fun, yeah. It's like, it's a little bit of magic, you know?
Yeah, it's coming to life.
It's almost like you're doing a seance. Right. The seance in the cocktail shaker. It's like, let's bring this back to life, you know.
Right.
This old bartenders and, you know, all these people that are, you know, in the great beyond.
And I love the George Washington. I like knowing some of the little stories about the president. I want to tell people that George Washington was much more of a distiller mm-hmm. than he was really a general. And
he was more of a general, but he was also a distiller.
He was also a big distiller.
In his last years, yeah.
So let's talk about that. He was our founding father, and we know of him standing, mm-hmm. crossing the Potomac. What did he make?
Well, in his last years, he wanted to be an industrial model for everybody in America because he had...
No pressure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, he was like, I've got the capital. I've got the knowledge here. Let mm-hmm. me pioneer various industries and show people how they're done and kind of research the best way to do it.
That's
and
cool.
distilling was
Thanks,
big.
George.
And, you know, so he said, let me put in a state-of-the-art distillery. Mm-hmm. And he had his plantation manager, this Scottish guy, do it. Of course, it was done with slave labor because he was a Southern landowner. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, how it was done. So it's... problematic to see that as a model for everyone.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, he did pioneer some of the technology, or at least put it to good demonstration. And he made like 11,000 gallons of rye whiskey in his the second year of operation, the year he died, and also made peach and apple brandy. I'm no peach brandy. I'm not sure about apple brandy, but probably everybody did. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was a way of preserving your crops. It was a way of monetizing your crops, and mm-hmm. so that's why they did it. You know, it's like mm-hmm. A way of storage and transportation. You know, with something that's worth actual money mm-hmm. that people will actually pay for.
Right.
You know, because so much in America they could grow themselves. They're not going to buy your grain. They can grow their own damn grain.
Right.
You know, or they can buy it locally. And so if you want to build a capital, you've got to have something that's
really interesting. I've never thought about that before.
Yeah, you need something that's worth actual money. That's not like barter, you know.
Right, because now we want to buy everything and not produce anything.
Right, we use money for everything.
Right.
But then, you know, most Americans were farmers and they produced their own stuff.
Right.
And they did their own distilling sometimes too, often. But mm-hmm. The people who weren't farmers would pay money for this stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and it was a useful cash crop, and it was a useful way of accumulating capital and getting paid ready money for your crop. So.
And then we could really go down the Appalachian Moonshine Road if we had 45 more minutes.
Exactly.
But well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And George Washington and machine guns and Peruvian Air Forces are just the beginning when you're researching and tasting cocktails. So you don't have to drink a historical one, but it doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah. If people want to learn more about David Wondrich and his excellent work that I research and use all the time, I basically cheat. You can go to thesouthernfork.com. I'm going to have links to his books, and you can click on the tab books from the show. You'll be able to purchase Imbibe and Punch for sure.
Thanks, Stephanie. That's
definitely
great.
From there. And if you like what you hear, we are always talking about something in the culinary realm with a Southern flavor. Please know that you can subscribe. And if you like it, please leave a review on iTunes. And you might want to listen to David's new podcast, which is called?
It's called Life Behind Bars at the Daily Beast, where I'm the senior drinks correspondent. And I write like histories of spirits and things for them. So there's a bunch of stuff on the site.
Good. Well, we'll definitely link to his podcast as well as the Daily Beast stuff. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you gonna eat all that?